This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Does the AFL and AFL Players Association reaction to the secret concussion contract deal pass your pub test? Pass any pub test? 1300 222 774. I'd love for you to hop on and tell me what you think, because the fallout from this case is continuing to hit the Geelong Footy Club, the AFL, and the AFL Players Association. If you haven't caught up with it, 24 hours ago we found out through some Herald Sun reporting that a secret deal was cut between Geelong Footy Club and a player that had him agree to bear all legal responsibility for his own future concussions. He was someone who was said to be at risk. His name is not public. Now, none of the people I've talked about from Geelong, the AFL, the AFLPA, have agreed to front the media. Interestingly, the AFL and AFL Players Association issued a joint statement yesterday. What do you think of that? They are in lockstep, and they are saying that the AFL became aware, weren't involved, but they became aware of what they're calling a complex and unique case, and that the Geelong Football Club has said that the waiver will be removed, but nothing else. No consequences for the club, or from the AFL, or for the AFL, no further investigation. What do you think? Does that pass your pub test? Is that good enough? No one's fronting the media. There is one person who would be particularly valuable to hear from. We don't know how much he knows. That's Craig Drummond. Now, there's no proof he can shed light on anything that happened. He's now, though, the AFL Commission Chairman, so he can answer in that role. He was president of the Geelong Board when the deal was done. He also was a director of the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health. As I say, there's nothing to say he has done anything wrong, but is this period where no one is saying anything to the media enough? Is a joint statement enough? Someone with very strong views on whether or not the AFL and AFLPA should have been issuing a joint statement or on their response, their lockstep response altogether, is former Players Association President Joel Bowden. He was on with RAF in the mornings, and this is what he had to say.
That the Players Association have put out a joint statement with the AFL. It is, they are too close, and that this example says to me that the industry has got control of the Players Association and they're funding them. That's the other part that I understand intimately because I was there for a long time. The AFL funds the Players Association to the tune of millions every year.
Do you agree with Joel Bowden's sentiments there? The fallout is only going to get louder for the AFL and Geelong and the Players Association. So we'll be continuing that conversation this morning. Join me. We'll hear from a neuroscience point of view and also a legal point of view. These AFL players do not get compensation in the sense of everybody else. They're not part of workers' comp. Should that change? We'll talk about that as well. Also today on the Conversation Hour, do we have enough support for young parents? In particular, they're pretty tired, right? If you're listening right now and you're a young parent, you'll be saying, uh-huh. No kidding, Mary. Yep, we're tired. The Monash University Accident Research Centre has found that 9 in 10 young parents have driven while fatigued in the past month. Now, that might not surprise people who've been through it or know people who've been through it, but it's pretty shocking when you hear it like that, isn't it? So that's a new study. They surveyed more than 1,000 parents with at least one child under 12 months to see how the disrupted sleep affects their driving behaviour. And they're saying it comes down to a lack of support for young parents. Tell me what you would say to a young parent, what your tips are. You've been through it. How do you get through this period? How do you cope with this lack of sleep, potentially, especially when it comes to driving? Let me know. 1300 222 774. Maybe you're going through it right now. You'd like to give a little bit of an insight, a little bit of a story to accompany those stats. I'd love to hear from you. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Bob, you're in Mont Albert North. What did you want to say about the AFL?
Well, apart from having to agree with the Richmond ex-player Joel Bowden being a Hawthorn supporter, it's just the nepotism. It's this ability to think that you can do anything wrong and then be able to cover it up and get away with it. It's the governance structures of the AFL and the... I agree with Joel. Just get the Players Association to be a more powerful union and maybe then we'll actually start looking after the players.
Bob, thank you so much. Do you agree with Bob? Thanks for calling in. 1300 222 774 if you'd like to join this conversation. Coming up next, let's get the reaction from a neurophysiologist. They look at this on the front lines all the time. What would this sort of waiver have meant for this player?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Professor Alan Pearce is neurophysiologist at Swinburne University and has been looking at this since before it actually came to light, commenting for the Herald Sun in its report. Professor Alan Pearce, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Mary.
You gave your opinion about this deal when we didn't know about the club. Now it's been revealed that it was a current player for Geelong. What's your reaction to learning that?
Yeah, look, I think my initial reaction still stays. For me, it doesn't matter which club is involved. It's the fact that they were trying to, I guess, put their own health as a club above the players' health, particularly their brain health, and allowing them to have the choice to continue playing and putting their brain at further risk of damage and also risk of brain disease for CTE.
What do you think that it says about the AFL to hear that response that basically it's saying, look, it's gone and let's move on?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's what we hear a lot. We hear nothing to see here. It's all passed. Everything's fine. Let's concentrate on the next round. And it just doesn't seem to actually get resolved. And as I learnt things through the day yesterday, what I found, heard was that, the player, after initially being told that, they were unaware, the statement that came out last evening, which you alluded to with a joint statement, that the player had been cleared by the AFL medical panel. But then the club had decided to go a waiver, and I know you'd be talking to a legal expert, so I won't go down that path. But for me, the concern is that if the club is not confident in the AFL medical panel, then surely there's something that can be done to tighten the clinical decision making around players if they need to continue or be medically retired. And at the moment, for me, it still seems too subjective and inconsistent.
Mm. So just to make that clear what you're saying, you suspect that on the face of it, by having this waiver, that the club, and again, we're saying this because we don't know, the club hasn't actually come out to say anything, but you suspect that the clubs did not trust what the AFL medical panel had said.
That's right, exactly. I think you've summarised it much better than I have.
No, absolutely not. Alan Pearce is the expert of neurophysiology from Swinburne University, and we're talking about whether or not this whole case is passing your pub test. John from Merbu North, what do you think?
Yeah, I guess my thought is a little bit if you swing it around the other way and the player's got a contract to play football, the club's potentially turned around and said, but hang on, you've had too many concussions. He said, hang on, I've got a contract to play. If that's your excuse, he's then potentially gone to his solicitor and said, hang on, I want to play footy. What do I need to do? And potentially said,
that he has that agency. John, what would you say to critics of this who say, was he in any position to make that decision, whether or not he had the faculties to do so, and should it be taken out of players' hands?
Yeah, I don't know. I just, I guess that my thought or concern is it's easy to sort of blame the clubs, but if they're sort of put in a position potentially, and I know nothing about it really. Mm. And it'd be interesting to see what your legal expert has to say about it. If he turns around and says, "Well, hang on, I've got a contract to play football," and you're saying it's a concussion, here's a waiver, so now I can play football. I want to enforce my contract. And potentially the clubs put in a position where they might not have a choice.
John, thank you. Interesting perspective to bring in as well. Before we go back to Professor Pearce, I just want to get to Ian in North Fitzroy. You're a lawyer. What do you think of this situation?
Well, I'm a bit inclined to agree with the last caller, and incidentally, I certainly have no allegiance to Geelong. Let's assume, and this may not have been the case, but if it were the case, that he had both expert medical and legal advice, and he weighed up the advice from the medicos and the lawyers, this young man was looking at perhaps another three or four years of football, earning a very large sum of money. Mm. Now, if that's the situation and he decides that he wants to run the risk, because knowing that if he doesn't run the risk, he will forego an awful lot of money, I don't see that there's anything wrong with this.
Ian, that's really interesting as well. Ian and John have brought a sort of a legalistic lens to this, Professor Pearce, and also medical as well, as Ian says, if he were cleared by the medicos. What do you have to say to that perspective?
Oh, look, they're both very valid points, and I guess this is why it would be great to have your legal person, you know, sort of go through this in a little bit more nuance, because from a scientific perspective, you know, as I said, the medical panel is really about, you know, a decision made on a subjective basis on expert reports. And, you know, it's always a juggle when a player should retire or not, and this is where some of the scientific research needs to be focused on, rather than just the diagnosis of concussion that you see all the time in the news about some new device that can detect concussion or something like that. And, you know, these are the big questions that we really need to address. And from my perspective, at least with, you know, studying players who've retired, you know, they have such ongoing concerns. And a lot of them said, you know, we just didn't fully understand the long-term ramifications, and now I'm really struggling. And yes, I have an older head on, you know, than when I was young. But at the same time, I just wish that people had taken this out of my hands, because I just didn't fully appreciate how serious this injury and this disease is.
And I guess, Professor Pearce, just before I let you go, that is not just a matter of wisdom coming to pass, as all hopefully happens to all of us, but is how much also is there evidence that someone who has had a history of concussions is even able to, does it impact their cognitive ability at the time of signing such a waiver?
Yes, exactly. And that's the, I guess, the question that we sort of don't really know at the point in time, but we certainly know that, you know, anything over three concussions does have effects on cognitive impairments, planning, what we call executive functions, so those higher decision-making capacities, and you know, it can be onset earlier in some people, it can be later in others, but it certainly has an effect, and that's the concern I have as a neuroscientist.
Thank you so much for giving us your insights today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That is Professor Alan Pearce, a neuroscientist with Swinburne University. This is The Conversation Hour. I'd love for you to join the conversation, 1300 222 774. We'll continue it next. Let's have a look at the legal situation, because AFL players are not part of any workers' comp scheme that might be for you and I.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So let's look at the legal angle here. I'm joined by Eric Windholtz, who's Associate Professor of Faculty of Law at Monash University. Thanks so much for joining me, Eric.
It's a pleasure.
What did you think when you heard that Geelong had done this secret deal with this player?
I must admit I was surprised. And on the issue of concussion in sport and concussion in the AFL in particular, it takes a lot to surprise me.
Right. What do you mean by that?
Well, in the sense of that this is it's kind of now turning into a saga that has lots of twists and turns. And sometimes you think that you've seen all the twists and turns, but a club taking the action to ask a player, and we don't know the player's identity, but I would assume it may have been a young player, to assume all the responsibility for any future injury that they may sustain as a result of a concussion is something that I just didn't think they would do.
Mm. Let's tease it out even further. The idea of a club signing a deal between it and a player and not including the AFL, how unusual is that?
Look, it is very unusual, and the response from the AFL yesterday in disavowing any knowledge of it and clearly stating in conjunction with the AFL Players Association that these type of agreements will not be part of the game going forward was very clear and very definitive. At the same time, however, the AFL has kind of just said, we're drawing a line under this. There's no more to be seen. We're taking no action against Geelong or not going to investigate it further, which seems also to be surprising given AFL's predilection to wanting to micromanage everything.
What do you think it says that no action is being taken? What do you think it says about the AFL?
Well, I think that in one hand, the AFL say that the health and safety and welfare of their players is their paramount concern. And here we have an issue that calls into question the manner in which those issues are being managed, and they're not prepared to investigate it. So I think it raises a lot of questions. It's a very easy for all of us to, I think, leap to the conspiracy answer. It may not be a conspiracy, but I think it just raises a lot of questions.
You believe they should come out and talk about it?
Well, I think that it warrants a fuller explanation, and from the AFL's point of view, maybe a fuller investigation.
And penalty?
Well, again, the penalty presumes that there is something wrong, and we don't. Mm. I think we need to go through the process before we get to the sanction. But you know, last week
on
the
that
AFL
point though.
Announced
Interrupt you, Eric, but on that point, you say something wrong. Prima facie asking a player to relinquish right to future action against the club. Is that prima facie wrong or not?
Look, I think we need to put this in its broader context. Mm. The AFL, Geelong, a number of clubs and the club doctors are facing a class action lawsuit. The outcome of the lawsuit itself is speculative, but it does raise the potential of multi-million dollar payouts. It is not, in that context, it is not unreasonable for one of the parties to seek to limit their liability in future litigation. So on one hand, it's not unreasonable. But then you've got to ask yourself, who is best placed to bear the risks, the health, safety, financial risks of playing football? And I would argue the player is the person least able to bear the risk. And particularly if it's a vulnerable young player, and we know that, you know, young players will, you know, they'll bet their future to live their dream.
Mm. You're listening to Eric Windholtz from Monash University. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Does it pass your pub test, the response of the AFL, or in fact the AFLPA, Eric? The joint statement was from AFL and its Players Association. What do you believe is the responsibility and the duty for the AFLPA in this situation, and is that response enough to be close to the AFL, in fact, in lockstep, it seems, with the AFL, and for nothing to happen from here?
What I would say is that I think the AFLPA, and indeed I think everyone needs to take, in a sense, a step back from the minutiae of the detail to see the woods from the trees. And the source of this problem is that players do not have access to adequate insurance and adequate compensation should they suffer a brain injury that is going to adversely impact the rest of their lives. They are the only category of workers in this country that are systematically excluded from workers' compensation. And that exclusion means they look for other sources. We have seen this year that the private insurance market has retreated. The Zurich Insurance no longer provides coverage for concussion and head trauma as part of their total and permanent disability cover. The AFL and the AFLPA have a joint injury hardship fund, which is good, but it's not comprehensive. So I think what I would like to see is the AFLPA take a step back from this and maybe take a step away from the AFL and say, what is the long-term holistic solution to this problem?
So they're outside the workers' comp structure. Do you, presumably, because, you know, there could be millions to be paid out, are they alone professional sports people in being exempt from that structure?
They're the only category of worker that is systematically excluded. There are some exceptions from that. For example, jockeys are covered, but professional footballers are not covered. This dates back to the 1970s when sport was first being professionalised in this country. Clubs and leagues were still amateur. They thought they may not be able to pay the premiums, and they successfully lobbied for an exemption. We're now 50 years on. If I just use the AFL, for example, it sells its media rights in the billions of dollars. Mm. The world has changed. Workers are now full-time employees. They should be covered, if not directly in the workers' comp scheme, in something similar.
Eric, I really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
That's a pleasure.
Eric Windholtz is Associate Professor of the Faculty of Law at Monash University. Lots of texts and calls coming in. Mark from Doncaster, what do you think? Hello, Mark. What do you think? You're a lawyer.
Yes, there's a saying in the profession, there are many. One is, ask 10 lawyers, get 10 different opinions. Mine differs from your previous legal caller who was saying informed consent is fine. I have never seen an employer-employee employment contract where the power balance was equal. There is always a massive balance in favour of the employer. Secondly, understanding something is not the same as being informed about something. Example, addiction. Unless you've had it, you might be told about it, informed about it, but until you experience it, you do not really understand it. Likely that the players will hit the problem in the future and say something like, if I had realised this is what that really meant, I would have made a different decision.
Yeah, Mark, that's so interesting. Thank you for your insights as a lawyer. Particularly, as you say, the power imbalance. What does it mean in this circumstance? Daniel from Albury Wodonga, thank you for listening and thanks for calling in. What did you want to say?
Good morning. I should clarify, I am not a lawyer, but I would sort of echo the sentiments of the previous caller, Mark, that I don't think the situation matters. You can't sign away your rights. Your employee surely still has some duty of care and responsibility for you. And in this case, surely the AFL and Geelong Football Club are the individual's employee. And no matter the circumstances, any sports person is going to want to play sport. And I guess when I think about this situation, I think, how would it be any different to like a member of the Defence Force? And we've just seen stuff around the Defence Royal Commission into veteran suicide, that people have a responsibility, the government, the Defence Force have a responsibility for the secondary injuries that occur after that person has finished serving, if they are secondary to injuries that occurred while they were during service. We couldn't have a contract with defence that says you waive away your rights for any injuries that might occur after you're finished serving. So I don't think this is any different to that situation in my mind.
Daniel, really interesting point. Thank you. And thank you to everyone who has been calling. And keep those calls coming through. I'd like to continue it. It's not going away. Certainly not for the AFL or Geelong or AFLPA. Joe asks, what happens when a coach sends a concussed back on the concussed player, I'm assuming, back on the field knowing there are no consequences? And someone else says, as Sting said, if you love something, let set it free. If we really love the game, we should take it out of the hands of the players. That will force change. Keep those calls and texts coming in. 1300 222 774. You're listening to The Conversation Hour. Coming up a little later in the hour, we are going to be exploring a new Melbourne Theatre Company performance that's all about what happens between the hours of midnight and 5 a.m. in our city, a fascinating production with a fascinating production process. But also I want to hear from you. What are your tips if you are a former new parent? In other words, you've been through those times of extreme fatigue. Tell us what got you through, because there's some new research saying there are a lot of new parents driving while fatigued. We'll come to that. Tell us what support is needed for new parents. That's next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
1300 222 774. Tips for young parents or parents with young kids. Because they feel old when those kids are young. Sometimes they feel really tired as well. The Monash University Accident Research Centre has surveyed more than 1,000 Australian parents with at least one child under a year old. And it shows that 9 in 10 have driven while fatigued in the past month. While many of us who've been through that situation think, well, that's not new, it is nonetheless very concerning and really important to consider. Sian Koppel is Associate Director of the Behaviour Science Team at Monash Accident Research Centre and joins me now. Thanks so much for joining me, Sian.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
As I said, it's important research, might not come as a surprise to a lot of people. Just how significant is that figure? 9 in 10 have driven while fatigued. How fatigued?
Well, so the participants reported that they were averaging about 6 hours of sleep per night, but the sleep was really poor, and almost all of them reported sleep disruption due to parenting responsibilities. And there's been some research that's been done at Monash University from the Turner Institute that's had a look at the relationship between hours of sleep and crash risk. And relative to drivers who've slept, you know, the 8 hours, the perfect amount, people who have slept about 5 hours have about a 5 times higher crash risk than those who've slept the 8 hours. So while the participants in our study were slightly higher than that, getting 6 hours, we do know that they may be impaired while they're driving.
It was often said that it equated to a certain amount of alcohol in the system, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. That it's sort of the equivalent of being around at least the 0.05 BAC level. So we definitely know that fatigue is related to near crashes or crashes, but certainly impairments in driving performance.
1300 222 774. If you're a parent with young kids, tell me about the stories that lie behind these stats. I want to hear from you just how dangerous that fatigue can be, and also any tips, any tricks that you've got for getting through. If you have come through this period and you've got some tips, 1300 222 774 is the number to call. I'm speaking with Sian Koppel, who is behind this research at the Monash University Accident Research Centre. Sian, you're talking about the influence on the body that mm-hmm. fatigue has. You talk about accidents. What else can it lead to?
Yeah, so fatigue is related to things like poor concentration, daydreaming or distraction, making errors, but it's also related to microsleeps, which are those sort of brief involuntary sleep episodes that can last a few seconds, which means that if you have a microsleep while you're driving, you're essentially not in control of the vehicle.
Mm. And also even staying awake, I guess it has to do with driver behaviour as well.
Absolutely. And so our participants, when reporting that they were fatigued while driving, they did sort of talk about some of the things that they were doing in terms of the tricks. So, you know, drinking caffeine, listening to a podcast or the ABC radio or putting their window down to get some fresh air. But the evidence really shows that those things might be able to stave off fatigue, but there's no replacement for actually having a nap or having a good night's sleep.
You're listening to Sian Koppel. We're talking about fatigue for young parents. And Sian, the research is not just about to show, give us a snapshot of what's exactly happening on the roads, apart from anything else. What you're talking about, what should happen from here. What's the perspective from the research centre?
Yeah, so what we're trying to do here is not blame parents. Mm. Fatigue is just a normal part of parenting, and we completely understand that. And unlike some of the other risky behaviour that we might study at our centre, whether it be distraction or driving while intoxicated or on drugs, fatigue sometimes is unavoidable. It's not illegal to be fatigued. So really what we're trying to advocate for is that parents understand the risks of fatigue. So whether that being providing that information to parents-to-be or once they've had their baby. So really them understanding the risks of fatigue, and where possible, and I emphasise, I know it's not always possible, but where possible, to delay non-essential trips or to share the driving, or if they have to go back to work, maybe negotiating flexible working arrangements or working from home.
Mm. You also, as you say, want that support to be wrapped around young parents. How much can employers do as well?
Well, I think that they can. Well, we talk about here at the centre in terms of a shared responsibility. So parents should be aware when they're feeling fatigued, but we want workplaces to also share that responsibility in terms of making sure that their employees get to work safely and get home from work safely. So if they can advocate for flexible working arrangements or working from home, we would really encourage that.
1300 222 774 is the number to call. We're talking about fatigue on the roads. Darren, you're an ex-truckie, and I'm tipping you've got some tips. Darren, what did you want to add?
Hi, Mary. Yeah, I certainly have.
Yeah. What's an appropriate tip for a young parent that a truckie would like to share, Darren?
Look, if you're really desperate, you can have no dose and that'll help you. But it's just a big caffeine fix, really.
Yeah, that's right. And I might get the medical opinion there potentially behind that. I have a feeling that might be a bit tricky, Darren. Anything else?
Yeah, I've got a good one.
Yeah.
Get out of the car and walk about half a K up the road. You'll be amazed just what the fresh air does for you.
Carrying a young kid or two, Darren?
You'll
give it a go.
Crashing into a tree, isn't it?
It's better than crashing into a tree. Darren, thank you. I'm not sure about your medical advice with no dose for sure, but really good to get your tips because truckies, yes, do know about fatigue. Sian Koppel, what would you have to say about the strategies when you are on the road?
Well, I think that these are short-term strategies that people are talking about in terms of drinking coffee or taking a walk to stay alert. But, we would be advocating for people to try not to drive fatigued at all if possible. And the only thing, as I mentioned before, the only thing that can cure fatigue is a nap or a sleep.
Mm. Sian Koppel is with you. She is Associate Director of the Behaviour Science Team at Monash Accident Research Centre. Just going back to basics, have you got any evidence that this leads directly to accidents? You were talking about all the other things that can happen, and it's obviously hard to draw a direct line between any causal element and the outcome. But what evidence is there?
Oh, so Monash University through the Turner Institute has done sleep studies where they've you know, deprived people of sleep or given them only a certain amount of sleep. And then they've put participants who have agreed to the study on a test track, and they've looked at their driving performance and their crash risk. The evidence is clear. Those who have slept less than 8 hours do have a higher risk of crash involvement. So, yeah, the evidence is clear.
And one day we must get you back to see fatigue versus mobile phones. Any verdict there before I let you go?
No, I think that they're both equally risky, but we do know that sometimes people who are fatigued try to engage with their phone to try to keep themselves awake, and so then they have double the risk.
Sian, thank you very much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Sian Koppel is Associate Director of the Behaviour Science Team at Monash Accident Research Centre. Chris in Pakenham, what do you think?
Just on the coffee thing, I used to be a cab driver for about 10 years and do a lot of long-distance riding on motorbikes, and things to avoid with caffeine, like a big charge of caffeine, is you have to pay for it later on, because the higher that you get swings the other way later on, and you get very, very, very fatigued.
Oh, Chris, it sounds like you've spoken from experience there. What's the worst consequence that you've had? What's the moment that stands out for you when you're talking about this?
Oh, you doing not so much with the cab driver, but with the riding, you get very vague. You don't realise that you're kind of drowsy, and it's identifying that is the hardest thing when you buy yourself on a bike. And
Would you recommend then, Chris, instead of caffeine?
Well, you shouldn't be doing it. You should have proper rest. Be prepared to go and do your shift or do the drive by not being. You've got to be in the right state of mind and body to do long-distance riding, driving, whatever. Avoid stimulants as much as you can. Inadvertent stimulants like having a stop for a coffee and stuff like that. One coffee over the trip might do you harm, do you much harm, but try to delay it as long as you can in the trip. Don't have it at the beginning, because you've got to pay the price at the wrong time.
Chris, thank you. Yes, if we're having a segment on fatigue, always ask a cabbie and a truckie. So thank you, Chris and Darren as well, for calling in. Really appreciate it. It is The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. We will continue our conversations. What do you think of what's happening with the AFL, AFLPA? I haven't seen anything jumping out to say that they've spoken to the media, but we will continue on that story. But coming up next, I'm going to talk about a Malthouse Theatre production that is really intriguing, not just the subject, but how they went about getting this material, giving an insight into that hushed inner world, as they say, of Melbourne's nocturnal community. If you are a night owl and you stay up between midnight and 5 a.m., let me know the best thing about that as we talk about this production from the Malthouse Theatre.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
We're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Vote now. Get involved at abc.net.au/science.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
And it's The Conversation Hour, talking about being fatigued. Those night owls that stay up between midnight and 5 a.m., I know you're out there. 1300 222 774. Maybe you haven't gone to sleep. Maybe you've gone to sleep and woken up again. Tell me the best thing about being awake at that time of the morning, because we are going to talk about a wonderful new production from the Malthouse Theatre. It's called Nightline, and Rosalind Odes is the award-winning NAR Melbourne-based theatre maker and dramaturge who is behind this Nightline performance and is here in the studio to explain, because it's really intriguing to me. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure, and good morning to all the night owls who are just waking up.
First off, before I go into the production itself, did you come at this because you yourself are a night owl?
Correct. Yes, I've had issues with sleep for a long time, and I'm quite intrigued by people who are kind of outliers, I guess. And yeah, so I'm very curious about people of the night, as I call them. Like, there are some people whose night is the equivalent of day and vice versa. And they're also visitors to the night hours.
What's the best thing about those hours for you?
It's like the city takes a different shape. It's very peaceful. And I particularly like walking late at night and just seeing those few little lights that are still on. And I feel like kindred spiritness to the people that are still up at that time. And I guess the work is trying to dip into the lives of those people who are awake between midnight and 6 a.m., whether they be shift workers or new parents. They're kind of an invisible community that I have great curiosity about. And, yeah, I guess a lot of people say it's that peacefulness of the night, like the gentleman that just called, like, you know, truck drivers and
cabbies,
even like overnight shift workers often talk about it's just a very quiet time. I mean, the challenge is not falling asleep, I think, because you often have to be awake for 30 minutes that you might be needed in those sort of roles.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it had such an intriguing last 8 months, specifically collecting anonymous voice messages from the people of the night in Melbourne.
Yes, and that is an integral part of your production, which we will get to. But if you are part of this invisible but audible community, join the conversation. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. So this is called The Nightline. Rosalind, you have pioneered headphone verbatim and audio-driven performance projects. Now, that's a mouthful. Explain how this works, how that skill and this production have come to pass.
Sure. Well, I guess to simplify it, my background is I'm very interested in documentary and I'm a documentary theatre maker. So I have theatre making skills, but all my works draw on real people's stories. So The Nightline is made up of real life anonymous voice messages, and it's sort of a immersive, crafted theatre experience where an audience member will come, they'll be led through this secret back door into a room full of little tables for one, and on each table is an old rotary dial telephone, a little lamp, and a little switchboard of 8 sockets. And your experience is, when you pick up The Nightline, you're listening into real life, a curated collection of real life anonymous voice messages from the people of the night in Melbourne. And it's quite an embodied experience, which I guess is where the theatre comes in. It feels quite like an alive phone line that you're tapping into, and you can disconnect and reconnect to different sockets and hear different voices. And because we're playing with this obsolete old technology, there's also ghosts in the machine. And the work sort of roughly maps a journey through a dark night and out the other side. So it's quite shaped, but everything is recomposed from reality, is a term my co-creator and I like to use.
That just sounds fascinating. So it's partly being in this isolated zone as an audience member that really draws you into what you're hearing over the phone.
Yeah.
The microphone.
And loneliness is a big thing. And those hours can be quite lonely, not always, but yeah, the work, I guess if there was a theme, it's sort of about loneliness and connection. Those old phones were designed for listening. And just that thing, like, I think we're listening to each other a little bit less at the moment. Like, I've just noticed people don't leave voice messages as much or have live phone calls. They're more likely to text. So the work is sort of like looking, I guess, a bit at, what we may have left behind and what it is to really listen. And I also think you can come away feeling more connected to your city.
Yeah, that is really interesting. 1300 222 774. I'm with Rosalind Oades. We're talking about the new production at Malthouse Theatre called The Nightline. And I'm asking you as well, this is about voices of the people who are awake, that community. I know you're out there, the ones who just love being awake and doing something. Tell me what you're doing between midnight and 5 a.m. Tell me the best thing about being awake at that time. Rosalind, you're talking about you can sit down at this vintage telephone and you can hear these voices. Where did you get these voice clips from?
Yeah, so the Nightline Melbourne edition was originally programmed for 2021 and was cancelled on opening night due to COVID. So I've been collecting messages from the night community in Melbourne for what's that? Maths is not my strong point. 5 years? 6 years, actually, because I would have started a year before. Mm. So I have a dedicated Nightline message bank service, which I with a phone number, which I've spread throughout the night community.
How do you spread? Where do you find the night community? Is it with a bat signal?
I wish it was that easy. They're a little bit elusive, especially because I, as a documentary maker, I want to get the most diverse cross-section of ages and employment backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, everything. Actually, the best way to connect with that community has been coming on late-night, overnight talkback programs. And the last time I was in this studio was with the lovely Trevor Chappell.
I was going to bring up Trevor Chappell, as you know.
He's such a community builder. I have so much admiration for those overnight radio hosts, because they actually build these communities. And because Trevor and other shows I've been on have such goodwill with their communities, they're great places to tap into the drivers. I mean, I've had 97-year-olds ring up through listening in. So it just, for me, being able to get that perspective, as well as a new parent calling up who's got a baby having a dance party. A pregnant mother with a baby having a dance party in her belly, paramedics, a garbage truck driver from Warrnambool called and talked about his technique for trying to leave the bins exactly as they were when he picked them up, so that the people come out and go, that's a garbo bin or not.
Mind tricks.
Dipping into all these little, like my description of the lights that are still on. It's just like that you feel like, hopefully as an audience, maybe you get to dip into all these extraordinary different invisible experiences of what's happening in Melbourne and Victoria overnight.
Yeah. This has travelled widely, yes, hasn't it? And you do this and you get these voices from each place you go, is that right?
Correct. I've got an ongoing collection, but in each city we do the work. I try and engage with that host city in the lead up, so to collect a fresh batch of calls. Because the thing I love about working with documentary is it really speaks to the here and now of what's happening in Australia. And I think it's such a gift to be able to listen to your own city. And just the act of listening and empathy building is something, I guess, community building is something I'm interested in as an artist.
And you mentioned isolation before being a bit of a theme. What are the sort of other stories that you get, or what type of things? Do people try to kind of leave amusing or uplifting messages, or, are they personal? Are they always about the inner life, because there's something about being awake at that time that makes you dwell in the inner life?
I think that is true. That's a good observation. I feel like it's the soul-searching time of night. If you're a visitor, particularly to the night hours, often you're awake because something big's happening in your life, or you're unwell, or you're, dealing with something. And there's something about being anonymous under the cover of dark that seems to bring out this quite raw, intimate quality. So time and again, I've been kind of overwhelmed by the generosity of the callers. We have a few regular callers as well, and one of my favourite Melbourne callers called the night her mother died and left a message thanking the nurses.
Oh, wow.
I've had a recent call from someone who is in their 70s who's just been evicted and is worried about, getting a new rental. So there are those kind of, and also someone whose leg was about to be amputated in 48 hours. So there are those really, some of them are startlingly in the moment of something big happening. Yeah. Another beautiful one, a new father trying to put his four-day-old baby to bed and reflecting. A young woman who's recorded her dad snoring. So it's a banjo player who's singing by the fire and playing a beautiful song about his dog. So it is personal.
Yeah, and intimate.
And intimate. Like. And there's also the people who it's just their job to be awake and they're quite bored. So when I'm good documentary is about what you leave out. So because I've got this rich palette from all these generous anonymous callers, I've got a really great selection to choose from.
So for anyone who's wanting to see the Night Lion and they sit down in front of this vintage telephone and they're operating a switchboard, essentially is it random? They're just picking whatever they get, or as a documentary maker, are you curating that in some way?
Yes, it's very curated. But so if you go with a friend, you'll hear different things, though. Mm. So there's sort of like 8 channels of phone lines that you can traverse the city by. So you could just stay on one channel. You could come 8 nights in a row and have 8 different experiences, or you could just move around and just enjoy that randomness of what it is to walk past a stranger in the night. Like, that feeling of being in a big city, it's like you don't know who you're walking past. It's that's the feeling I'm trying to create.
You don't know you're walking past, but sometimes when you're going past them and you're thinking, what are they thinking? Yeah. This is that step, isn't it?
Well, you know, everyone's got a story and mm-hmm. every voice is as unique as a fingerprint. Like just the way people talk, it reveals so much about them.
I love that thought. I just have to ask you, as I say, you've gone to Sydney, or this production has gone to Sydney and Adelaide and been in Quebec as well.
I know, in French.
In French.
Who knows what they were saying?
Well, I hope someone did. Any particular a Melbourne audience is just the best.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. That's what we were
That's a short about. Answer.
Yeah, Brian Nankervis knows a leading question when he hears it as well. Malthouse Theatre, The Nightline, and this is on from the 13th to the 29th of August.
Correct.
Thank you so much for joining us, Roslyn.
Oh, thank you so much for your support of the arts.
Roslyn Odes is behind this. It is at the Melbourne, the Malthouse Theatre, and it is called The Nightline. This has been not The Nightline, it's Conversation Hour in the middle of the day. We've been talking about a lot of things, including fatigue. Keith, what did you want to say?
Yeah, hi, Mary. I was reading something only the other day that was talking about biphasic sleep, which was a thing pre-industrial revolution where people used to sleep for 4 hours and then they would wake for 2 hours and they would like pray or catch up on chores or whatever, and then they would sleep for another 4 hours. And it was only when the industrial revolution came in that factories needed workers to work 8 hours, and a mattress company put forward the idea of sleeping for 8 hours. But before that, it was 4 hours. And William Shakespeare wrote his best work from 2 to 4 o'clock in the morning.
There you go. So big mattress wrecked it all for us. Is this why I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning, Keith?
Possibly. Your body wakes up and says, I need to do those chores that I forgot to do during the day.
Do you do that? Do you get up and write some Shakespearean stuff?
No, totally not. I got bought in by the marketers in the mattress company. I sleep for 8 hours. But it is an interesting concept that we don't actually need 8 hours.
It is, Keith. Thank you. Sleep is a whole other thing, as I say, hard for new parents, but really good if you're a theatre producer like Roslyn Odes is as well, for those sleepless people. And join me again next week for the Conversation Hour.